Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 54 of ZK Live. It is Sunday night. We're going to be doing the Q&A. We had not as many questions as last week, that's for sure. We had a few questions to answer about touching up gloss, different types of gloves we use, using a four-stage turbine to spray Holland-Lac, brushing Holland-Lac, and then I'm hopeful that we'll have some questions that come in while we go through the podcast, because otherwise it's going to be a short episode, or I'm just going to be talking to myself, which I tend to do anyway. But before we get into questions, we have a new hire this week. Very exciting. Lots of cool projects going on. We just wrapped up that wine room just in time for the holidays. Top secret wine room. Unfortunately, we can't post pictures of it. The client is very private, and I don't blame him. He has an unbelievable home, and the design and the build team did an unbelievable job. So we got to come in and use a Mohawk wiping stain on this gorgeous walnut cabinetry, and a passage door as well. The door and some of the stuff you saw on our feed that was in the shop, we were allowed to post because it happened in the shop, and my man Dan Schaffner down there, he was the architect of our stain and clear schedule. That guy is a wizard. We're really lucky to have him as part of our team when it comes to projects like this. The client gave us a sample. The designer gave us a sample and said we want, that was not on walnut, right? Just, it was a stained sample of some wood, and said we want the walnut to look like this. So my man Dan went to work. Did a few rounds of custom stains and matching and clears, and we finally arrived at a Mohawk wiping stain. Because then we had plywood and hardwood that were slightly different colors, and they were taken stained differently. And so we were trying to, without having to do toning of the whole project, we had to try to find a stain that would be as close to the sample as possible, but also have the most uniformity across all of the pieces of wood, which is really interesting and really not an easy thing to do. But luckily we had our team to execute. We had Dan to as the architect of the stain and clear schedule, and we knocked it out of the park. You know, it's good. Unfortunately, in our business, in the custom world, we were working for the guy who built all the cabinetry. So we don't get pats on the back very often. You don't get the phone call that's like, oh my God, that looks so awesome. When you don't get a phone call, it's a good thing, right? We executed, we came in on time, which, you know, in the budget it was a hard number. So we came in on time and on budget. I decided not to charge an extra fee for the rushed schedule. When we originally planned on doing the project, there was not this tight timeline. But then what ended up happening was one of the guys from the GC's company got injured. It pushed their whole thing back a couple weeks. So we had a week and a half, two weeks less of a timeline to get the project done. But that's the beauty of having a little bit larger team. We're able to flex people around. Like, that's, as a custom painting contractor, that's what we do. We move people around. We try to have a wide variety of skill sets so that people can, our shop team can go out on site and vice versa. We do that a lot. We move people around. You know, we were able to take Dan. Well, so let's see. The project started with Patty and Caroline. Patty and Caroline went from start to finish on the site work, which was really cool. They prepped the space. We sanded. Our sanding schedule was, we sanded everything with 150 grit by machine, and then we sanded everything linearly by hand with 150 grit after that. Once the sanding was all done, you know, that's a majority of the work, obviously. It's a good portion of the work, and it's very important. We eased all the edges. We got it all prepped and ready. We masked the entire space, and then we used a wiping stain The wiping stain smells horrible. We had to wear respirators and use air control. But, man, it turned out beautifully. Once we had the stain on there, we were able to come back the next day and start. We used our Kremlin on site, and we sprayed a conversion varnish from ML Campbell called Crystal. It's non-yellowing. It's super clear, unlike some of the two-part polyurethanes that have a little amber to them. Dries really fast. So we were able to, we put three coats of clear on site within a couple, 2 days. There was a countertop, and because of the nature of these products and the spraying and this, it was a full paneled room. The countertop was just always getting dusted, right? And it wasn't super smooth. So what we ended up doing was we finished three coats on everything. Then we went back and we masked it off and we sanded the countertop and we sprayed the countertop all by itself on the following Monday, just so that we were able to isolate that horizontal surface and spray it and be done and not try to keep a wet edge in that big space. And, you know, horizontal versus vertical on a bunch of air in a small space, it's just tough. So, but luckily we were able to draw on Dan's experience doing a lot of stain grade stuff, both Dan's in this case. And then meanwhile, while the site work was happening, we were able to be in the shop working on all the stain work there. Caroline came to the shop, and Caroline and Cameron actually stained it all the site work, the shop work. And then myself and Caroline sprayed three coats of clear in one day on all of that shop work, which without the booth having the heater, the makeup air unit, first of all, we had a makeup air unit, so we were able to run the booth at 75 degrees while we sprayed instead of, you know, it was like 50 degrees outside. So we would have been running 50 degree air through that booth. Not ideal. So we were able to spray at 75 degrees. And then when we finished a coat, we were able to bake it at 125 for 20 minutes. Come back, it was done, ready to be flipped. Flip it, spray the other side, back and forth. So we in the time period of one day, we were able to get three coats on all sides. I don't know. I'm so grateful that we have that booth now. It's such a valuable thing to have. It helps us with timeline, because as a custom contractor, we are trying to offer super high quality coatings, awesome customer service, and the flexibility to get things done fast. You know, that's not always there. I don't have a Chris Polidoro Shoreline 80-man team, but I have more than two people. So we're able to flex people around. And that's why we're keeping two-person teams. And but those can be moved around. And that's what's really working for us in the custom world right now. And it's allowing us to hit deadlines for multiple projects. And, you know, we're doing a project for Silver Phoenix Construction a little before this project, right before we started this stain project, because we were waiting for the wood to be installed. We were able to take the team, go start prep on a cabinet job in Andover for Silver Phoenix, and now we'll go back to that in a week from Monday. A week from Monday, we're going to be back there to finish that. And we have 3 days to finish it. So again, we're going to be able to flex some people. So, you know, I'm really grateful that we've gotten this team down. We have leads that run apprentices, and now we've just hired a new apprentice for the Phil and Hollis team, so they'll have three people when they need it. But also, Darius is going to be able to flex. Again, he's going to start in the shop. So I think the flexibility is becoming more and more of an asset, and something that we're selling more and more to clients is not only can we achieve an incredibly high-level finish, but we can do it on the timeline and put the bodies in place where we need them to be efficient and minimize time on site, blah, 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 blah. As you can tell, I'm super excited about how that project turned out. It was obviously when someone comes to you and they're like, oh yeah, we're a week and a half behind schedule and we still need to be done for the same timeline. You know, that's stressful, especially when you're trying to achieve a super high level finish on a lot of very expensive walnut. You don't really want to mess that up. And so we planned, and when it came to executing, you know, we were really lucky. We took lots of cheap insurance along the way, doing anything we could to make sure that we could achieve our outcome, and we nailed it. So super, super excited about that. The team is firing on all cylinders. Let's see. Phil and Hollis are brushing out tons of Holland Lac Satin right now. They are commuting all the way out to Cape Cod, which is quite a hike. Luckily, there's no traffic right now. But they drive all the way to Cape Cod, and they are brushing out for probably our most particular client ever. He's awesome. He's our perfect client. He cares about all the little details, and he wants it done right. And he's willing to pay what it costs to do that. So they have been having a brushing extravaganza. Really loving those Stahlmeister brushes. Stahlmeister sent us a few brushes, and we kind of just sat on them for a while. And if you guys saw that video that we posted, that, I don't know, four-inch wide maybe brush that they have, super, not a lot of bristles, really thin, but lays out the Holland Lac amazing. We were doing lots of rolling and tipping on larger surfaces with oil. So one of the questions somebody had was about brushing Holland Lac and tips. I mean, you got to put it on thin. You got to practice a lot. Like, don't go start on a project. Practice. You got to put it on thin. Please, yes, someone just ask a question. Please, all your questions, there's a little question mark button. I'm 4¾-inch wide brush. Like, crazy. But it's perfect for, if you saw that project that we're doing, there was lots of paneled, what do they call that, nickel gap boards for the ceiling. So, worked out really well. I'd love to hear if anyone else has had this issue. Pretty sure we had a bad batch of Grip-Rite. The Grip-Rite was fuzzing up on us and deteriorating super fast. Way faster than I would ever expect and have ever seen Grip-Rite wear. Usually we love it because it's super durable and it's not going to catch dust and it's not going to shed. But on this project, man, we had to pull up the Grip-Rite, flip it over onto itself, and we're going from there because the Grip-Rite just isn't, it didn't perform the same way that we're used to. So I'd love to hear from anybody else if you've had issues. I think that's one of the things that happens when you're buying roofing underlayment from Home Depot. It's not designed for us. It's probably, the quality control is probably not as precise as we would like it to be. And as a result, we are going to be now on a hunt for different floor protection that we can hopefully get more predictably and have it perform better, because dust in your paint costs a lot more than spending a little bit more on floor protection. That's for sure. And that's what we were finding was like serious stuff in our paint because the floor was like shedding fibers. I mean, it was ridiculous. Phil made a post about it, but so yeah, the keys to brushing Holland Lac, number one is practice, not on things. Practice on sample boards, practice vertically on sample boards, horizontally on sample boards. Different brushes, different thinning ratios. Test your viscosity of your paint. Don't just take it out of the gallon and don't just add percentages. Find out what the viscosity of your paint is. That's Shoreline bought. You have to buy 2 pallets worth of the floor protection to get it custom labeled. And I've been trying to do that. I have a supplier who's willing to buy 2 pallets for us and we'll buy from them. And Grip-Rite just won't even answer the phone. So now we're on a mission to find new Grip-Rite or a new floor protection that we can get our logo put onto and we can get and know that it's going to be working. That was kind of a pain in the butt, that's for sure. But luckily we caught it early and we were able to fix it. Let's see. So there's that. Let's see, we had... So we like the backside of Grip-Rite, but the problem is if you flip Grip-Rite and put the front side down, that, as Phil was saying, the labeling can transfer onto the surface that it's covering. And now you end up with the opposite of what you want out of floor protection when it's staining your surface. So we love Grip-Rite because of its ability to protect the floors really well. Like it's generally very solvent resistant, very waterproof. And it's incredibly durable. Usually you can like really move it, abrade it, and it's going to stay consistently strong. But this, like, you could just see the lettering was fading away fast and it was like, I don't know, not ideal. So you live and learn, but it's on our radar. I think there's stuff called Gator Grip. And I'm sure there's a couple other companies that make a similar product. But we are definitely going to be doing some testing on that because I would love to get a better product and I would love to have our logo on it the way Shoreline does. Yeah, John was like, oh, that'd be awesome. Then we finish your walls and you end up with a ZK stencil on your hardwoods. Which, you know, we've seen that and we've had to deal with that. Luckily we've caught it and fixed it. We had no big issues with the transfer, but we found out that it's an issue. So we don't want to put the label side down. Let's see. We had somebody ask a question. This is a good one. AVL Renovation and Repair. So North Renovation and Repair says, do you have any advice for someone who still hasn't figured out their ideal job or client? Yes. I have some thoughts on this. Honestly, I think you have to, it's going to take some meditation or some deep thinking from up above, looking down on your business from a objective view. But like the first thing I would start with is like, what are your skills as an owner? Like what are your superpowers? Take some personality tests, figure out what you're good at. Not just like specific skills as much as like what type of work gets you going. What type of work are you really good at? Generally those two will probably line up, most of the time. If you want to have success, the stuff you like to do, hopefully you're good at, if you're trying to do this as a business. But I think you kind of want to look at, like, for me, like, I love doing high quality work. It's what gets me going. Nothing gets me going more than like deconstructing best practice, executing at a high level and getting an unbelievable result, right? That's what I wouldn't be in the painting business today. I'm sure I would have left if it meant I had to do commercial repaints or commercial painting or slap it on, hurry up. My customers cared about price a ton and they just wanted hurry up. Like if that's the business I had to run to be profitable, I would not be in painting anymore because that's just my personality. We just had a guy leave the company that thought he wanted to do high-end work, but turns out he wants to just cut and roll walls all day. And that's what gets him going more. And he wasn't satisfied and didn't love doing the type of work that we do. So there's probably more people are like that. Whatever it is that gets you going, I would recommend first starting there. And then from there, that's all awesome, right? If I love doing super high-quality work, but I was in the middle of nowhere, Oklahoma, or Kansas, where I grew up. If I was in the middle of nowhere, Kansas, and I wanted to do super high end work, guess what? Like, there's not a market for it. So, even if I had gone, well, this is what I'm really good at. This is my passion. This is what I love. If there's not a market for your services, it doesn't matter. It's a hobby now. It's not a profession, right? So, I think you have to combine. Where's the market? Is it, and ideally you find a market that's underserved, right? It's a fairly competitive business that we're in because the barrier to entry is fairly low. So if you are looking to be a cost effective or inexpensive paint company, you surely can do that, but you better have some serious competitive advantage and you better really hone in on what makes you special at doing that, because there's lots of guys who get laid off. You pick up a brush and a little giant like I started and start painting for very low rates. And so if you don't want to be in the race to the bottom, obviously there's companies who do a more production minded mentality of painting. And they do well, but they've figured out all of the efficiencies that make, and those are run like businesses, right? Those are numbers driven, very, very efficient organizations. They are buying paint in huge bulk, right? They're getting unbelievable pricing on paint. They have very refined systems. They have very skilled painters, right? Their painters are skilled at working fast and getting the job done, where my guys are skilled at executing at an incredibly high level, efficiently. So you don't have to get into the high-end world, but you have to figure out what you like and then what is there a market for. And honestly, if you're wondering, like, just do, right? I think no matter what, you have a company, it looks like North Renovation and Repair, like, you're doing stuff. So keep doing stuff. But reflect. Go back. And I did an exercise with my a friend of mine and a sort of mentor in this business who the first time he was like, all right, let's go back all of your jobs over the last year. Let's get them in a spreadsheet and let's write next to them. Was this profitable? Was this not profitable? Do I want to do this job again? Is this a great job for us? Is this a good job for us? Or is this a job we're not going to take in the future? Right? And if you go back and you reflect on what you've done, which I know I did not do very much of that for most of my early career, right? I was just painting and trying to survive and, you know, but if we can take a step back as business owners and look and go, how is this going? Like, I realized I didn't put my earbud in. This probably will make for better. Let's see. We'll see. Does that sound better to anybody? I have to think it usually does. But I think going back and doing what they call like post-mortems, right? Looking at a job afterwards and deconstructing it a little bit. I'm not saying spend an hour on each job, but even just, you know, 5-10 minutes kind of go, did this go well? Did this not go well? And why? And I think when you start to see your company through that lens, you'll start to hone in on what kind of jobs are profitable for you. Are you happy where you are at as far as these types of things? Now, you might find that you're profitable in jobs you can't stand. Well, I mean, depends on what motivates you. But for me, I had profitable jobs that I didn't want to do more of. So I had to change my whole business model, right? I had to build a company where we could be profitable doing the type of work that I liked. You know, I think, I don't know. That's the gist of what I'm going after. I hope you understand kind of what I'm talking about. Is don't try to defy your biology, right? If you hate doing meticulous, detail-oriented things, don't get into the high-end painting market, right? Because now you're going to be you're going to be hating every single moment of doing the type of work that you're selling, right? So I'm a big advocate of like, I'm always reading books about human biology and like studying mine and trying to harness my nature, my DNA, like how am I wired? And also like facilitating the best from that DNA and that wiring. So don't set up a company that's profitable doing things you can't stand. If you care about loving your job, if you care about making profit, that's a different thing, right? Go get your MBA. Figure out how to make a profitable business. Who cares about what's actually being done? And some people just love being profitable business owners and selling their companies and building another one. That's a thing too. But I think you have to figure out what you love, what gets you going, and then hopefully there's a market for that. Now, if there's not a market for that, you may need to look at something else. But I don't know. I hope that explains what I'm going after. It's just, I think in the beginning, there's a fine line between staying afloat and putting food in your stomach and a roof over your head. And so you have to do that. You have to stay busy enough to not, and then there's also like, well, I want to get someplace. So I have to say no to things and I have to hone in on my target market. But if you're new, you don't have a lot of demand for your services. So you kind of have to take what comes your way and slowly move in the direction where you want to go. And I'm a big believer in that. That's what I did. I think in the beginning, you just like, you know, stay afloat. You know, if you can just stay in business and not go bankrupt and not work 100 hours a week and have like a balanced family and work life, and maybe you don't love everything you're doing in the first couple of years, but you're learning and you're getting a little bit better every day, right? Each project, I can track the projects over time. Now, it wasn't completely linear, right? There was up, down, up, down, up, down. But we've been going up, down, up, down, up, down, higher and higher and higher. You know, we've been elevating the type of work that we do, and it's not been direct, straight line, but we have definitely been getting better projects and getting better at doing those projects and honing in on what we like to do and what we're good at doing, and just getting a little bit better every day. And honestly, what the heck else can you ask for out of life? But just be a little bit better today than you were yesterday. And that might not be tomorrow. I might be worse than I was today, but how about let's look at it over a month period. This month better be better than last month. I better be trending upwards. And if we can trend upwards as people, I don't know what more you could ever ask for. Let's see. Some people are agreeing. See, like John from Paint School just said, he would not take on a gloss project, right? Because he has built his company to over years and lots of trial and error to figure out what he's good at. And when you figure out what you're good at and what you make money doing, after you've done it enough, eventually it becomes very clear what doesn't fit that. And that's what I mean. Like, just stay alive and keep eating, keep paying your taxes, keep paying your overhead, put enough money to get to the next job and just get a little bit better job to job. And you look at all these people I've had on the podcast, some of these super successful business owners. And I see like Adams and Beasley, I was talking to Eric Adams on here, and you see where his company is today. He has 50 plus employees. Their company runs like a Swiss watch. They have a profit sharing program. Everybody knows how much cash is in the company, the cash flow of the company projected out for the next 18 months. It's just like so freaking impressive how well that company runs and the level of execution and the level of employee they have and the company morale and all of those things, right? And I'm sure they're profitable at this point. And it's so easy to look at that and just be like, well, I'll never get there. Well, then you talk to them and come to find out it took, you know, 15, 20 years, whatever it was, to get to that point. So I think just staying alive long enough to get a little bit better for the next time that's half the battle someone smart said the only way you like lose in business is if when you go out of business, like you always have tomorrow to get better. So I think there's a fine line between like being profitable. Like if you're profitable instantly, like, man, you're a better person than me. I don't know what that looks like that was not my story. But we've been doing a lot of macro thinking, like Hecker Payne just said. I spent a lot of time thinking about the macro and building that out to what does it look like when we get, where are we going? Like, are we just, in the beginning you do whatever, but hopefully you're doing whatever to slowly formulate a path. And here's my North Star, and I'm going to start to work toward it. So thanks for your question, North. Here we go. Remnant Restoration. How did you go about painting multiple interior doors prior to purchasing Fast Rack? I started out, I remember the first time I ever saw the accordion method for interior doors, my mind was blown. We hadn't done really any new construction at that point. Start with Why. That's a great book, man. Simon Sinek, I believe, wrote that. It's a great book. Yeah, you have to know your why. But to answer this question, we did a lot of the accordion doors on new construction. You know, whatever, you mask off a room, you go to the basement, you go to the garage, whatever it was, you put boards across the top to hold the doors and they make an accordion and you could spray them all. That's fine for if you have the space. It's fine if you're not trying to achieve a super high level product. It's tough to get into like doing really good detailed sanding to doors, especially the type of doors we do. That's not going to be very feasible at this point. So I started doing that, right? You can scuff a door real quick. You spray a couple coats on. It looks good. Moving on. Like, you know, depending on what your target market is and your client, ideal client is, and the expectations of the client. I mean, that works great for lots of people. Then I got into the door decker system when I was trying to get a little bit higher quality finish, right? You take the door deckers, you put them on the tops and bottoms of the doors. You can now work on the door horizontally on sawhorses. So now you can more easily prep and prepare a surface for paint at a higher level. And then when you spray, you can spray horizontally and you can stack them, and it takes up a smaller space. But then we were getting into these custom homes where there's four different heights of doors in the house, right? And now the door deckers aren't lining up to stack, so you have four stacks of doors because there's four different heights of doors in the house. Or then you're getting spacers, and you're putting spacers on all your on the different doors to get them all to be the same height. And then they weren't exactly the same height, so then you had this flex in the door deckers, and then one door decker snaps off, and they all come crashing down, and oh, man. And then you have to get the vertical dry rack system, because all the doors we ever work on are solid core doors, so you can't leave solid core doors horizontal overnight. That's not a practice I would ever feel comfortable doing after having a project where all the doors bowed. And then I learned you shouldn't keep solid core doors. I didn't even know until we put the doors back on. We had to have a carp. I still didn't even know that we messed up for a long time. Probably a year afterwards, I didn't even realize that we had messed up. But we had all these doors came off a house. We put them back on. They didn't fit. We had to have a carpenter come in, banging and messing with frames. And never occurred to me that the doors were bowed. Until later, I don't really know how it happened, but eventually you realize, like, oh, wait, these solid core doors shouldn't be left horizontal for any extended period of time. We don't do them. We would never leave a door horizontal overnight. That's a rule in our company. Everybody knows it. We will always stack a door vertically. So door deckers do have a system where you can rack the doors vertically. On sawhorses, and I've done that, and that's not a bad way to go. It's still a pain in the butt, but I didn't have any money then, so even the investment in door deckers was a big deal for me. So fine, right? It got me to the next step. It kept me moving. We got work done. We made some more money. But as our labor rates continued to increase and our demand for our services increased, and time was more valuable than money, in a way, like the equation shifted. Where now, I remember the first time I bought a fast rack, I didn't even have a use for it yet. I bought my fast rack like with a plan of one day. I don't really know. I guess I thought that's how I was going to do gloss doors. I don't really know, because the first doors we did, what was the first door I did with a fast rack? It probably wasn't even a gloss door. It was just like two doors we were doing or something. I was excited to have one. Maybe it was for a gloss door. But, you know, that first time I spent $1,000 on a fast rack for one door, I was just like, this is insane. It was so much money for me at the time. Holy crap. I couldn't believe it. But I saw how, like, you get a fast rack door handle. Even if you don't get the racks, guys, just get the handles and figure out the racks if you have to. Because the handle from fast rack is out of control. When you pick one up, you're like, oh, I get it. I get it now. I get it. Mike builds his stuff like they're ready for the apocalypse. They will make it through the apocalypse with you. They are so well built. It's not like these companies that are engineering for every little penny, because they're going to sell a million of them, and these are the production guys. All they care about is the money. They are making a profitable business, and no one's going to really complain, and moving on. Mike is building a painter. Mike is a painter. For 20 years, he had a painting, 20 plus years, he had a painting company. He built these racks for himself. So he built a rack the way he wanted a rack. The first rack he ever built, I'm sure it's still being used today. When you see his equipment, it's like truly something you've never seen before. I've never experienced anything like the level of craftsmanship and just, I hesitate to say overbuilt, but they're overbuilt. I mean, for the average project, especially hollow core doors, which is what he was doing a lot of. But he had a whole system. He has a whole system where you can do a bunch of doors all by yourself. If you're in the shop, you have one guy in the shop, and the other guy called out today, you can do all the doors by yourself. He has a whole system. It's amazing the way what he's designed. That's kind of been my progression. And then we had a project where we were super tight on space in the house. We had a high level of finish to do, and now all of a sudden it made sense to buy a fast rack setup that could handle 23 doors, which we did. And so the carts are amazing because they're used for multiple things. So we bought a cart, two carts with vertical dry racks on them would hold 22 doors. So then you have one cart to spray on, two carts with vertical dry racks. Now you have 23 doors that you're working on in one little tiny room. We were in a small room and we had 23 doors and we were executing on a super high level and we were racking them all vertically. And these were solid, heavy freaking doors. And we were able to rack them all, no sweat. So that's the progression. So, no, we always hang our doors vertically overnight. And in fact, we spray all of our doors vertically as well. We gloss doors specifically. But really, we've gotten into... I mean, if you guys saw that video of me spraying the clear crystal on that walnut door, I sprayed it vertically and I left it. Yeah, we actually spray our gloss doors vertically, because we're high level painters. We are very skilled. We've dialed in our paint process in a way where we better be able to spray a door vertically, right? We are able to spray vertically. Well, the advantage to spraying vertically is in a gloss setting is dust. So if you have a door that looks like this and dust is settling down on it, now we have a state-of-the-art spray booth, still get some dust, right? But dust is settling down on this, like, there's a very small surface area for it to settle down to. Versus if you flip it sideways and flip it horizontal, now you've just put this big, I mean, think about it. It's like the difference in dust on a countertop versus a wall when you spray. There's just going to be more dust on the horizontal. So we are trying to minimize that. Plus then you're not leaning over the top of the door, which I know is like, it's neither here nor there, whatever. It's probably nothing, but I think it's cheap insurance. If assuming you can figure out a way to spray vertically, I think there's a lot less, mistakes that can happen as far as things that are out of your control with dust and nicking it with your arm or the, sometimes you'll see like, the Tyvek suit, if you have a big one and you don't tape it around your waist, might like touch the edge because you're leaned over. I really like working on doors vertically. That fast rack equipment, it's, I don't know how we would do without it. It paid for itself so many times over. Like, that's the crazy thing is, like, again, now time is more valuable than money for me. I'd rather spend $5,000 on racks and save myself dust and resprays, because a respray because of dust costs us like $600 per coat, maybe a little more. A respray for sags, that's more like $1,000, but that's not going to happen. We try not to ever have that happen anymore. I was the last one that did that, and that was a huge mistake on my part. So we spray Holland Lat cabinets vertically. We spray oil. I try to always spray oil vertically. When we're using 2K polys, no, we're spraying them horizontally because we can just do it so much faster. And we're not worried about dust the same way that we are with oil anyway. So we spray a lot of cabinetry horizontal, but anytime we get into oil, we're going to spray it vertically. Yeah. Plus then you can spray both sides at once. For dry times, that's far superior when you're talking about oil. The 2K polys, we can bake them 20 minutes later, flip them. But when we're spraying Holland Lac, we're definitely going to spray it vertically. If you can't justify the purchase of Fast Rack right now, I get it. But what I would probably look to do then is just buy the handles. It's like $80. Buy the handles and you can figure out some mechanism, or you know what you can do, buy the handles and the 360 lock. That might cost you $150. And then you could theoretically, for the short term, you could rig up a 2x4 frame or something as a short-term version if you don't want to spend all that money up front. But I think I've seen guys make their own versions, and I'm like, guys, for $40 per handle, you're telling me the time you spent building that handle, that was cheaper than spending $40 a handle? I would argue completely against that. Now, if you don't have enough work and you're sitting around with nothing to do and your time is not valuable, fine. Like, that's what I did. That's when I built the craziest jigs you've ever seen. I would spend, God, I wish I could go back and show you this jig I made, this dry rack I made to dry shingles when I did like 30 boxes of shingles. I sprayed both sides of 30 boxes of red cedar shakes. And I made a contraption the size of the footprint of a little bigger than a car in a garage. It was a footprint bigger than a car. I made this big framework, and I took twine and I ran like double strands of twine across as many heights as you can and as far apart as you could to put shingles on the twine. And I would lay like 20 shingles across the twine to dry. And then I filled that entire rack with shingles. It was ridiculous. And it was so time consuming. And I didn't know what the heck I was doing. But I had all the time in the world and I had no money. So you do crazy things because it just makes more sense. The icebreaker with the heater is out of control, man. It's out of control. We have not used the heater a ton since the Eco, because we just haven't had time to stop and do the R&D on it. But we will be doing more of the R&D. But the icebreaker is awesome. But really, the big difference is the gun. The GM 4700 is... I'm a huge, huge fan. I never thought I'd find a gun better than the Golden Gun. When I first heard people saying that this gun was better, I was very skeptical. But... honestly, I would say, I mean, the Kremlin, the finish that you get from them is not different. Like, I would be hard pressed, and I think anyone would be hard pressed to prove you could get a better finish with the Wagner gun than you could from the Kremlin gun. That's not what I'm talking about. So if you have one or you're thinking about getting one, the Sight gun is great and will get you an unbelievable finish. The difference is in the maintenance and the ease of use. So there's the tips on the GM 47s can be flipped around, blown out, put back in. It's not as fast as a flip tip, but like you can do it. You can just turn them around, they seat back in, you can blow them out. I've done that a number of times. It's very useful and saves you time. There's also no O-rings or anything that can go bad. So that's a huge thing for maintenance. So, and you can take the filters out without tools. It's a tremendous gun. If you're getting one for the first time, I would go Wagner. But if you have a Kremlin, like, don't switch. They're not going to get a better finish. Both of them are awesome guns. Let's see. Somebody asked me a question about spraying Holland-Lac with a 4-stage turbine unit, HVLP. I would say try it. I would say don't expect to get the results that we get with an HVLP. If that's all you have and that's all you can do, like, you can get some good results. If your clients aren't happy with those results and you want to go to the next level is a conventional gravity-fed setup, like an automotive gun. It requires lots of air. 12 CFM of air versus like 2.5, 3.5 CFM of air from a turbine unit. So you're talking about way more air, way more atomization. And then there's air assisted airless. Those two we can achieve the highest level finish possible. But to say you can't spray them, especially the lower sheens, like, definitely you can. And it just depends on what are like, a 4-stage, I wouldn't recommend it. If you're looking to buy a machine, like, don't go buy a turbine unit. I'm not a big fan of turbine units, honestly. They're fine. I think that there's definitely a better... You can take a gravity-fed automotive cup gun, put a pressure-fed cup on it, And if you have the ability to move two medium to small size compressors to a job site, you can get, to me, that's the most versatile. If I'm buying one sprayer that's not an airless, and I'm price conscious, I'm going to go buy like a SATA or a DeVilbiss Techno or a SATA 5500 X-Jet with a pressure-fed cup gun. A pressure-fed cup. That's the big piece. If you have a pressure-fed cup and you have that gun and then you have enough air to power it, which requires two compressors unless you have a gas-powered compressor, with that gun, you can spray water-based coatings at a very high level. You can spray oil-based coatings and solvent-based coatings at a very high level. It's incredibly versatile. And it costs less or about the same as a turbine. The cost of it, I mean, so we looked at the price of a top-of-the-line Rolls-Royce gravity-fed gun and the pressure-fed cup is about $1,000. A SATA Jet 5500 RP with a pressure-fed cup is about $1,000. You can get two of the roll air compressors for under $1,000. You get the hoses, wiring. You're maybe $2,100. And now you are achieving the highest level finish you can get. Now, that's the same cost as a turbine unit. The difference is the turbine unit is a little more compact. It's easier to move around. It's smaller. But it has 3 CFM of airflow, you know, versus 12. And, you know, it is what it is. It's just different. But that's honestly, I think that's a great way to go. Yeah. And that's what I mean. If you have one and you're happy with it, like don't switch. But if you're looking to get in, buy a setup, I would buy that type of setup I was just talking about, an automotive cup gun with a pressure fed system, and get the airflow necessary. You'll be at the same price as a turbine. Just it'll take up a little more space. You'll have to get two medium sized compressors. But like you can work around that, you know, you can figure that out. But you'll the capacities, I mean, it's just night and day. Anyone that's come to ZK Finishing School and grabbed a SATA Jet and with the pressure fed gun and sprayed water based coatings, like it's ludicrous. And because you're talking about 12 CFM of airflow, you're talking about an automotive cup gun. Like this thing is the Rolls Royce. It's so well engineered. And, you know, there's just a big difference between that and a turbine unit. And like John said, it's a 2-in-1. You can unplug the gun and you can blow dry your hair. Turner said he loves his SATA. And Kendall Friesen Fine Finishes, he came to see, both those guys came to ZK Finishing School. And Kendall does agree the atomization is better. There's no question. When you look at the particle size that you can get, the atomization you can get out of that SATA, I've never seen anything better. You know, the DeVilbiss does the same thing. I'm not going to say there's a huge difference. But yes, for your first air mix gun, I would go Wagner over Kremlin if I was buying one for the first time. Yes, I have no like horse in this race. But I will tell you, I'm a big fan of Total Finishing Solutions and Supplies because it's a place I can go online and buy stuff. Like, I went online the other day and I bought that ultrasonic cleaner, right? Like, I was like, this is my big... I like the idea of being able to lay at home on the couch at 11 o'clock at night and buy stuff easily is very appealing in these modern days. So I like Total Finishing Supplies because I was able to go on there for like $1,100, I was able to buy that ultrasonic cleaner. And I think Dan started trying messing with it the other day. But I bought a lot of stuff on there. And they sell right now, I don't know if the price is still as low as it was, but he has a deal that if I was buying my first air assisted airless setup, I would 100% go with. $2,200 for a 14-to-1 air driven piston pump and a Wagner 4700 on a cart. Very, very cool setup and an unbelievable price for at $2,200. Like that, you can't beat that. So yes, honestly, when you first start spraying gloss, it's like I was the type of guy who I went out, I bought a DeVilbiss Techna Pro Light. I bought a pressure pot and I got the airflow I needed because the best guy I knew, Adam Fox, was was using that setup. And I was like, whatever Adam Fox is doing, I'm going to go get his setup and I'm going to use it. So I just posted actually a reel today where I was spraying primer on that gloss room that we did. And that was with a DeVilbiss Techno Pro light and three compressors. I didn't have two super efficient compressors at the time. So I had to run three compressors to a manifold to power that automotive Techno pressure fed system. But I mean, the atomization you could get with that was out of control. So I was like, again, in the scheme of things, spending money on tools and equipment at a certain level becomes not the expensive part. But I understand we've all been in a spot where $2,000 is a lot of money. And I don't care if it's going to make you money. If you don't have it, it's or sometimes not the best. A lot of times we all are having in business. Where is the best place to spend the $2,000, right? I would say, here's what I'll tell all you guys. I think having a professional lettered vehicle is better than a great piece of spray equipment. Obviously you have to have some spray equipment. So whatever you have, you can probably figure out an airless and get great results for the most part. If you're driving around in an unlettered vehicle, I think you're making a huge mistake. And the $900, $1,200 it costs to get a professionally done, clean looking vehicle is such a good investment. Will lead to so much more work. It will pay for itself like this. I can't even tell you. The lettering on my truck and my trailer have paid for themselves. And now we're getting a fleet of minivans soon. And we're working out with the company how to get the lettering right. And I'll tell you, I can't wait. Those vans are going to pay for themselves just because they're driving around as like rolling billboards. You know how expensive a billboard is? You get to have one that you drive to the neighborhoods that you want to work in. It's so powerful. So that's a whole nother thing. What was I just going to say? I just had a great point. It was going to be freaking... Oh, huge tip. Anyone who's about to... If you're going to get lettered vehicles or you're thinking about it, I highly recommend don't just put a magnet on the side. Get a nice, clean, lettered up vehicle. The way to do that in my experience, the most cost-effective way by far, is to go to a large, like tractor trailer. Place I go to is called New England Truck Solutions. They repair tractor trailers. They do full vehicle wraps on 18-wheelers and the huge freaking trailers they pull. They do massive amounts of vehicle lettering. And if you look, those companies are estimating based off of square footage of stuff printed out. So I will get my bill and it will say, you know, 43 square feet of navy decal, 22 square feet of white decal at this price per square foot. Because that's how they bid. They're doing these huge tractor trailers. So they have a very efficient team. Their costs are low. Their installation costs are low. They're efficient. So I got an unbelievable deal and continue to as I continue to use this company because of their efficiencies. And I'm a small project for them, but they bid by the square foot. So I priced out going to like cool design, like letter vehicle wrap companies. And they were so freaking expensive for the exact same thing I got. So I would look at going and looking at the tractor trailer places for sure. All right, let's see. We're at just about an hour, and I just finished my first Waterloo. Cracking my second one. Sponsored by Strawberry Waterloo tonight. Thanks, Waterloo. We love you. It's not true at all. But it would be cool if they sponsored me. And I have a vicious heating and cooling problem in my office because I did this bootleg thing where I cut holes in the ductwork and put vents in them. So whatever the thermostat is downstairs. And I had to turn the heat. Either I was going to be baking in this space or I was going to be warm to start and start to get a little bit colder. And that's what just happened. But I'll deal with it. So let's see. Let's talk about, somebody asked a question about gloss repair. I can probably pull that one up. Yep. So what do you do when you get a nail pop and a beautiful new gloss ceiling? Ooh, best question. Best thing to do, there's only one thing that I mean, really, there's only one thing you can do, and it's respray. It's fix the pops and respray. But, you know, that's what gloss is, a luxury product, like exterior stain is. And, you know, we've have some nail pops on that gloss ceiling, and we're going to go back and respray, and the client's going to have to pay for that to happen because it's not our fault. You know, you just have to be realistic. Like, this is not, you know, nothing's perfect, and it's going to show everything, and it's an expensive product and process. And if you want that luxury gloss look, you have to be willing to pay for it. This is not flat white on your ceiling. And it starts with having clients that can afford this type of luxury, you know. And if they can, you know, part of the deal is, we're going to do everything in our power to fix every nail pop that's there to start, if there is any. And we're going to fix them all properly with multiple screws on either side, take the screw out, and then we're going to fill it. And, you know, we're going to do everything we can. But if a nail pop happens, that is not on us. And if you want it to be fixed, honestly, you probably have to fix it and respray the whole section. Whole wall, whole ceiling, whatever it is. Not an awesome answer, but it's the truth. And I mean, you can try spot touching it up, waiting 2-3 weeks, and then buffing the whole wall. If you have the old paint, you might be able to get away with that. But by the time you do that, that costs about as much as just respraying. Or at least as much inconvenience. It depends. Sprayed gloss, not something that really touches up. We just tell people you can't touch it up. Someone asked about the gloves we were using. Those gloves, they're green gloves. We got them from our supplier. We don't like them. The best gloves, I'm not going to tell you the best gloves, so I can't find them. No, I'll tell you. If you guys can find them, good for you. The orange gloves that we use, I think they're called, they might be made by Raven. No, they're not, are they? Oh man, there's orange gloves. They're sold at O'Reilly Auto Parts is where I've usually been buying them. But since COVID, they just don't have them. They're like behind the counter. They're not out on the shelves. You have to ask for them. But they're these like bright orange, super, super strong. They're amazing gloves. Like they rarely fail, and they're super tough. They're a couple bucks more for a box, like whoop-de-doo. Awesome gloves. If you can find those bright orange, can't remember what they're called, but they're good gloves. Hendrick Woodworks asks, have you ever buffed Hollenlack? I have experimented with buffing Hollenlack. I've never buffed Hollenlack for a client. I have no interest in doing that at this point. Honestly, it's just not even on my radar. No. Astro Grip, I guess is what they're called. They're bright orange. They are durable. They have some grip to them. Tremendous gloves. Tremendous gloves. Let's see. So we have a new apprentice, Darius. Super excited. He came as a referral from a paint contractor, Well, lead that's on Instagram, the Herbal Painter New Hampshire. Kayla Jordan. She's one of the leads for Pro Image. If you guys don't know Pro Image, Steph was on this podcast, when we first started it. She's amazing. They're FPE certified. They use tons of FPE. She's sort of like building, she's creating a fine paints market. There was not a lot of demand, if any demand, in her area. And she's just using the paint and building demand. And she's proof that you don't have to be in New York City to sell FPE and do really well. So they have an awesome company. Great follow on Instagram, Pro Image. And I got an email from Darius, and he said that a friend of his was a painter was Kayla Jordan. And she recommended that he reached out to me, and that he was an artist and a very passionate artist, but wanted to like turn that into a trade and make a living doing something and learning a trade. And, so we interviewed him, and he checks all the boxes, right? If we were to, you know, you draw up what is our ideal apprentice going to look like. And he checks all the boxes. So it's like, great, you're hired. Now, how is he going to perform? I don't know. Nobody knows but Darius. And it may be something where he decides this isn't what he likes. Or he, you know, which if he likes it, generally, I would be a couple times I've had it happen, actually, so I can't say that. But if he likes it, I think he's probably going to stick around. He'll probably be like, generally, he'll probably be a good fit. We have a pretty strong company culture, and if you fit in that culture and you are, you know, are you down with ZK Painting and what we stand for, and you love the craft and you love customer service and you love making things beautiful and giving them 100% while you're working, you're probably going to be a good fit here. I have had a couple people who are a little delusional and they loved it, but they didn't understand how bad they were and how slow they were and how they just weren't cut out for this at all. And those were the two, those were tough firings, because most of the time people just kind of like get it. They're like, yeah, this isn't for me, you know, and we part ways and, you know, this isn't working out. That's what I tell everyone when I fire them. Like, hey, this isn't working out. That's it, man. Like, I'm not going to scream at you. I'm not going to yell at you. I'm going to give you plenty of chances. I'm going to give you, you know, critiques to try to get better. But if you don't, like, hey, this isn't working out, like, see you later, man. I'm sorry. But our team is so important, and no one person is worth messing with the team. So very excited to have a new person to try. But I've had enough people, I've hired enough people where you can be very excited. It really just comes down to how does he perform in the field? What do the leads say about him? And, you know, trust my leads. And we give people, by the time, if you make it, if you get a shot on the roster, like, we are going to do everything in our power to empower you and to facilitate your greatness. And so, you know, and that's our job as that's my job as a manager, and as a lead's job is to facilitate greatness in these people who are apprentices and are trying to learn the trade. And so we have to do everything in our power to teach them and, like, put up with the learning curve and all of that stuff. I don't mind firing people, although I haven't fired the last few people. But, like, firing just means, like, hey, this isn't going to work out. Like, this isn't working out. Like, it's not like, oh, you're the worst guy, get out of here, you freaking suck. Like, that's not how it goes. It's just like, hey, man, you're not, this isn't working. You know, good luck. I wish you the best of luck. You know, but this isn't a good fit. And all I care about, I mean, the people in this company are the most important thing in the company, by far. More important than me, they're more important than the clients. It's our team is everything. We sell labor hours. And if we don't have an awesome workforce and awesome human beings, then we're not competitive in the market. So the team is everything, but this will be our first time experimenting with three people on a team since we sort of went back to teams and not just, I don't really even know what I'm saying. Like, we're going to see how it works out. You know, we're always growing and getting better and being more efficient, but, you know, Phil and Hollis need a third person on some of these gloss projects. It's going to make things more efficient. So I will probably do very little work with what am I saying? It really depends on the project and what's going on. Like, last week I had to get in there and I worked with Caroline all day long, like, pretty much from start to finish. We got out of here at like 8 o'clock at night and we had crushed it that day. And I got to work side by side with her. That's awesome. That's not the best use of my time on a daily basis. Generally, it was the best use of my time that day because we had to get things done. And, it is what it is. I'm going to step up and do that. I loved it. I mean, selfishly, I freaking love painting. So I got to, like, spray clear all day. Like, what's better than that? But, no, I rely on the leads and then the apprentices that are working with the other people. People who have been here to help teach and guide and you know, we're pretty open, pretty, you know, it's like, here's how we do it, and we're not expecting to be fast. When you first start, you're expected to be proactive, You're expected to, like, to not make the same mistake twice. You're expected to try to be getting better, to try to be thinking about things. We don't want just doers. We want people who are thinking about what they're doing. So we're going to encourage all of those things. And we're going to roll with the punches. People make mistakes. I make mistakes. Everyone in the company makes mistakes. So a new person coming in is going to make a plenty of them. But we're going to try to limit those. We're going to try to make sure they're not the same ones over and over again. And, you know, generally, it's been my experience that it's either a perfect fit. I think as you get a more refined company culture, the more refined and the stronger it is, the easier it is where it's just like, this absolutely is a perfect fit or this is not going to work. And as I've been in business longer and refined that, the time it takes to figure out if someone's a fit or not, it just gets shorter and shorter and shorter. And oftentimes it is like a mutual understanding, like, hey, this is clearly not working. You know, which is a beautiful thing. Level 10 Painting says, how does the new 98 compare to the old? What makes it better or worse? All right. If it was up to me, this is very controversial, but whatever, it's the truth. If it was up to me, I would much prefer to use the old stuff, but we can't use it anymore. And if we wanted to buy Hollenlack at all, they had to change the formula, and so they did. And there's advantages to it, but there's also some disadvantages. The advantages being, it's easier to work out of the gallon. Requires less thinning. It's really nice to brush out of the gallon. Doesn't require much. Phil, are you thinning your Hollenlack when you brush? Or I think you might be adding a little tiny bit, but not a lot. It is non-yellowing, like way, way more than the old stuff was. The old stuff was a true, as an oil, like it yellowed in absence of light. It's always a good one. It's always interesting. It's the absence of light that makes it yellow, not a bunch of light. So closets, pocket doors, they turn yellow over time because of the absence of light with oil-based paints. Well, the new 98 has an unbelievable color retention and stays white much, much longer and yellows much less than the old stuff. Another huge benefit. I lost a massive job, well over six-figure job in Florida, in Miami, that we were going to do in Hollenlack Brilliant on a bunch of walls when they told me they're going to put up a bunch of art. And I said, well, if you leave that art up for 2 years and you take that art down, you'll be able to tell where the art was. It will be a different color. That square will be a different color. And they were like, well, we don't like the sound of that. Never mind. We're not going to do Hollenlack Brilliant on the walls. But that's, you know, it is what it is. So the new 98 has a much less yellowing to it, which is awesome. It also dries much slower. So we don't like that, right? It's already a slow dry oil. Like, it's a long oil. But in many cases we have seen, it might take 2 days to dry to sand. Not in many cases. But it's not unheard of for a black, it without ideal conditions, to take 2 days to dry before you can sand it. So it takes longer to dry. It doesn't love to be heavily thinned with FPE mineral spirits the way the old stuff was. The old stuff we would thin 30, 33%, 35% with FPE mineral spirits, and we would get freaking glass. And it would be ready to sand the next day. And the new stuff, I would not highly recommend against putting 30% FPE mineral spirits in that paint. We've had there's cratering issues that happen with it. It's temperamental with solvents, and you have to really test before you do a project. And the more you thin it, the longer it takes to dry. And it's just different chemistry. And so the main reason I don't like it is because I had a perfectly refined process. I spent hundreds of hours, thousands of dollars refining my Hollenlack Brilliant process to we were crushing our spraying of Brilliant. It was so predictable. I had no issues. It was just like clockwork, right? And that took a long time. And then they were like, oh, now you can't buy that paint anymore. So I had 40 gallons of it in the basement of my paint supplier, and we're pretty much out of it now. There's like 3 gallons left. So now we're using 98, and we're doing all of that same trial and error process to dial in our processes to achieve the same clockwork results. And anytime you have to start from scratch, that sucks. So thanks for your question, level 10. So that's the end of our questions. I'm waiting to hear back, but what's the name of the Wagner Air Assist? It's a GM 4700 is the gun. And Icebreaker, I believe, is the name of the pump. I think Wagner has a few pumps. The pump we have is like, it's way overboard. You don't need a pump as big as our pump. I think it's a 18 C40. So it's 18 to 1 with a 40 cc piston. It's a freaking big pump. It'll pump multiple hoses at once. You don't need something that big. I think 15 to 1 at a whatever. The 14 to 1 that they sell is probably just fine for most people. I have been in contact with, if any of you guys have seen some of this coverage, do you recommend the Wagner over conventional with the SATA? The only reason I would ever recommend getting the Wagner is if you're doing large jobs. The SATA is tremendous, but you wouldn't want to do a room with it. You wouldn't want to do a whole house worth of trim with it, right? So it really depends on the size of project is the only deciding factor. For a lot of reasons, you'd want to go SATA for as long as you could until you... Because cleaning out a machine takes over a gallon worth of solvent right there, and you have to fill the line full of that paint. It's just not nearly as efficient as I can take 5 ounces of paint, put it in a SATA, spray all 5 ounces, and clean the gun with 1.5 ounces of thinner. Like, it's super efficient. But if I'm spraying an entire freaking house worth of doors, I'm not using a gravity-fed cup gun. I mean, you would just be there for freaking ever, and you'd be filling that pot 100 times, and it's just not, it doesn't make any sense. So the level of finish you can achieve, I would say, is on par. There's not a difference. So the reason you're going to look at the two different machines is really going to come down to the size of the projects. You can run 5 guns with a 410 tip on that Wagner Icebreaker that we have. So it's overboard. You don't need that big of a pump. Back to Tonestir. So if any of you guys have followed the controversy of this guy, I can't call him my buddy yet because I don't know him that well yet. But Tonestir Paints, I think it is, on TikTok. He was a Sherwin-Williams employee. He was mixing paint. He has like 1.4 million followers on TikTok. He makes these videos where he mixes paint. They fired him. He brought a business plan to them, asking them or suggesting to them, like, hey, I have this big following. You guys could leverage this. Let's do some marketing here. Like, let's take on and let's use this following. And anyone who understands anything about social media understands how valuable a following is. You can leverage a following for a number of different reasons. I don't care where your following is at and who they are. If you have 1 million people following you, there is value and there to be leveraged there. 100%. And these big companies and these old guys don't always understand that. They think TikTok is stupid, or they think whatever, they're a bunch of kids. It doesn't matter. 1.4 million followers is 1.4 million followers. And if you're smart, you can leverage that and do pretty well. But they ignored his proposal. They didn't even want to talk to him. And then a couple weeks later, they fired him, saying that he had been mixing paint on company time and blah, 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 whatever it was. Not only did they say no to this guy who comes to them with a business plan and is like, I have a big following and I've just been messing around on TikTok by myself. Like, let's get Sherwin-Williams power behind this. Let's go. And instead they fired him. So out of control, he's now been hired by Florida Paints. He's going to do just fine. He's moving to Florida, but I think we're going to have him on the podcast on Tuesday. I'm really excited to talk to him. We did a decent amount on TikTok during the COVID for a little bit. We were making dedicated TikTok videos. I had the interns doing it this summer. It was fun. And then the interns went back to school. I didn't spend any time thinking about TikTok anymore. And I don't even know what we'll do with TikTok. I've been posting some videos up there lately, but not putting the effort in that I should to really make quality content for TikTok. But I'm excited to talk to him and hear his experience. I want to hear, a lot of articles have been written about this whole thing, and I really want to hear his take on social media. And so I'm looking forward to that. I'm waiting for a confirmation back for Tonester Paints on Tuesday at 7 o'clock. So this has been a Sunday night Q&A, and I'm getting pretty cold in here, and I'm out of questions. Why do you thin the paint more than the rent? Oh, my friend G, let me just answer this question real quick. He says, why do you thin the paint more than the manufacturer recommends? Because the manufacturers don't know crap. They don't publish any, okay. If you're a manufacturer and you are writing a technical data sheet for a residential painter. Now, if you're getting into the commercial industrial coatings, generally those TDS sheets are written much more factually with way more research behind them. Generally, I would say residential paint from a domestic manufacturer, if you read those TDSs, most of them are this copy and pasted from a bunch of other ones. Like, here, you should use a 417 tip, a 517 tip, right? What Sherwin-Williams water-based paint does not say you should use a 517 tip to spray it at 2000 PSI, right? There are so many forces driving a TDS sheet from a domestic paint manufacturer on residential paint that are not looking out for the painter achieving the best result possible. They are covering their ass quite often. They're covering their ass. They're also just saying super conservative things. Like, you guys ever see on primers, it'll say for plastered walls, wait 21 days before painting. Why? Why? Why are we waiting 21 days? They could say, here's the pH that you need the wall at, and here is the moisture content you need the wall at. If they meet these two things, you can now paint that wall. Well, rather than saying that, I don't know. I would love to hear the honest answer why, but I think they just think we're all stupid. Instead, they say 21 days. Because, A, no one's going to listen. So then they get to say, well, did you wait 21 days? And you'll be like, well, no. I had to actually get some paint on a wall. And they're going to be like, well, then you didn't follow our manufacturer's recommended whatever. So I don't trust TDS sheets. Are a great place to start. But then you need to test. You need to break your paint. You need to break your paint on either side of the spectrum. Don't thin it enough. Thin it too much. What does it look like when you overthin it? Have you ever taken a product and thinned it too much? Sprayed test panels at 10%, 20%, 30%, 40%, 50%, 80% thinner? Do that. Find out what are the parameters that you can play within. And if you haven't broken the paint, if you've just listened to what they say, I mean, it's fine if you're just slapping on paint, not thinning anything, moving on. But if you're trying to apply coatings at a high level, you have to do the testing yourself. I would not trust Sherwin-Williams to test out duration and give me an honest TDS sheet that's going to tell me real parameters that I cannot, that I have to follow. I just don't trust it. Because I don't know. Yeah, it's not been my experience that those are very believable. So someone said, any tips on how to not get dots at the edge of the spray pattern? Using a 208, 210 tips. I did not get dots. I'm not sure I'm following with what type of dots. I mean, increase your pressure, thin your paint a little bit, or filter your paint. I mean, the right, having the right filters in the gun, but also filtering your paint ahead of time might help the paint flow out better. Will help the paint flow out better. You might increase your pressure, or you might thin the paint. Those thick coatings through a 208, you know, if you're having spray issues, you may want to thin them down a little bit. Resources for spray, for cabinet spraying that you would recommend. I'm not sure. I mean, there's, you come to ZK Finishing School, we'll help you. Cabinet spraying, test, man, practice. There's books you can get about general spraying stuff. Spray, what's that book I have? I think it's called Spray Finishes, Spray Finishing. But, you know, play around. There, when we go to paint something, we have lots of variables to control, right? We have the pressure. If we're using air-assisted airless or gravity, we have the air pressure as well. We have fluid pressure. We have air pressure. We have viscosity. We have distance from the substrate. We have speed at which we move the gun. We have temperature. We have angle. That's seven variables right there that I can think of. So you have seven variables you can control when you go to spray something. So control them and think about them and adjust them and practice and look at the results and then do some more of it. And do, like, I don't know. If you're finding issues, that's what I would start with, is change some variables around, keep testing. Before you go to a finished product. This has been episode 54. It's getting chilly in here. I loaded the truck up for tomorrow. We are starting a garage paint. We're painting a garage. This is going to be one of the coolest garages you've ever seen. So we're going to be using Fine Paints of Europe Uni Primer. Really cool stuff. We're going to be cutting and rolling ceilings and walls. Wait, there's two car lifts in this garage. The client has an unreal car collection. And so he has some unreal vehicles. And so he has these, is a three car garage, but he has two vehicle lifts so he can park five cars in his garage. They just have the floors epoxied, and we're going to be painting one wall, an accent wall orange. So we're matching the flake in his epoxy floor. So it's like, it's a gray, black, and bright orange flake. Four different colors flakes. So we have, we're going to be painting one accent wall bright orange. We're going to be painting a couple of different shades of gray, and we're going to be painting a black wall. So I think one of the ceilings is going to go gray. The two walls across from each other are going to go a different shade of gray. The back wall where the garage doors are is going to go black, and then the big wall on the other side is going to be bright orange. So Caroline and Patty are going to be prepping the surfaces, masking everything off. We have a couple baker's rack staging. We're going to stack on top of each other because it's a high garage, high ceiling. And we're going to get in there. We're going to prep the surface. We're going to fix any imperfections. And we're going to use Fine Paints of Europe Uni Primer. We're going to probably use some sort of a gray shade. We're going to prime everything in gray primer. And then we're going to use Eurolux Matte on all surfaces. We're going to sand between coats. We're going to make everything nice and smooth. And then we're going to get the lasers out, and we're going to make some stripes. That's going to be pretty cool. We'll get the masking out and follow laser lines and make some little racing stripes using all the same colors and just different patterns. Cyber Monday special. I hope he's not. I know that Mike charges an incredibly fair rate for his products. I know they're expensive. I'm not saying they're not, but in comparison to the market, but I also know that his margins are not huge. And I don't see how he could be doing a Cyber Monday. I don't know if you heard that or if you're just asking, but unless he said something about it, man, those racks at sticker price are well worth it. that's not a guy I'd be looking to try to get a deal from. There's plenty of companies I would, but I would try to support Mike and pay sticker price on those. That's just my opinion. But if he's doing a fast, the Cyber Monday special, I have no idea about that. But yeah, take advantage of it, man. If he's going to give discounts, take them. But honestly, his stuff is so well built and such a great value. Whatever he's charging for it is, it's a great deal. Let's see. I still have half a seltzer, guys. No more questions? No, I should go. Just asking, as I have an estimate so ready to pull. Yeah, pull the trigger. I don't know. It'd be crazy if he had a Cyber Monday special. It's not the kind of company with the kind of margins that you're used to working with, where like the, what is that, paint line or whatever, that guy's just like mass selling cheap, underbuilt or not overbuilt, let's just say that. Now he's selling not overbuilt racks for very competitive pricing. He's not touching manufacturing. I'm sure it's being manufactured out of the country. I'm talking out of my butt. I don't know. Maybe it's not. But Mike, everything Mike's doing is American made, well overbuilt. He paints it all himself. Like, unbelievable company to support. My wife came to me this year, and she's like, for Christmas, I want to buy as much stuff locally as possible. And I was like, Sarah, I am completely on board with that. So I like that idea, right? I'm a local small business. I'm a small business, but like when I can, yeah, I'd like to think a little bit more about buying local and small businesses and supporting people who are working hard. And generally those types of companies don't have the margins that, some of these bigger companies have, where they can just, anytime you see, like, I'm not going to get in saying names, but I saw a paint thing the other day, where anyone who's giving 50% discounts off stuff, like, whew, man, that's like, to me, as a consumer, if you can, that throws up red flags and makes me not want to buy from you. If you can afford to put 50% discounts on your products as a promotion. Now, I mean, I don't know if you are like, this is last year's like shoe and we have a new shoe coming out, and it's like the Jordan 12s and the 11s are on sale. That's one thing. But if you're selling the same product tomorrow for 50% more than you sold it today because it was on sale, like, that means you have some crazy margins. And I don't really know. That's just fishy to me, right? I could never imagine if someone asked you for 50% off your price. I'm like, so you want me to pay you to paint your house? Like, no. I mean, I don't know. What am I even saying? But I'm going to be definitely thinking about supporting. I always do. I'm like a regular at all the restaurants and coffee places. And like, I try to support local businesses and be a regular places and spend my money. You know, you vote with your money, you vote with your dollar. Like, that's our most powerful tool for voting on things that we want in this world or don't want. So I'm definitely trying to think more about that. So go support Mike. I freaking love that guy. Anyone who talks to him, like, God, he's just salt of the earth. Awesome human being. I love his products. He's just a great dude. So that should be the end of that. I should go. I'm going to go home. I'm so glad I got in early today and I loaded everything up. Two sets of Baker's Rack, a couple of Little Giants, stuff to sand walls and blah, 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 but it's all loaded up. I get to just jump in the car, drive home, see my wonderful wife. I hope all you guys have a great week this week. I'm excited for Tuesday's podcast. Thanks for listening tonight, and we'll be back soon.